How about some midweek madness? Hello and welcome to episode 28, yes 28 of the Real Football Cast. I'm your host Dan Tracy and in the next 60 minutes we'll be dissecting all the hot topics in football. As per usual, we'll be discussing what has been going on in the Premier League over the past few days. But in addition to that, there are also some off-pitch activities that have caught our eye and they'll be getting our attention in the next hour. Joining me tonight is the return of Matthew, our guest. Well, I guess yes, he's our resident Fulham fan. And I guess, well, you'll be glowing after Tuesday's win, won't you?
Yes, absolutely. We haven't had a lot to cheer about in a long time, so it's good to finally realise what a win feels like.
Right, we'll discuss a bit more on that, well, actually quite a bit of that later on. But first, before I chat all things football, I'd best do some social media bits first, otherwise I'll be talking to the abyss once more. So, if you want to get in touch with me, you can. That's on Twitter, at StanTracy1983. Anything show-related, send it my way. You can find me via iTunes by searching for Real Football Cast. And if you use that platform, then don't forget to subscribe so you don't miss a single episode. And if you're not a fan of all things Apple, you can find me on SoundCloud and Acast. Well, the easiest way to find all the links is by going to realfootballcast.com. As you should know by now, the Real Football Cast is sponsored by Loserpool. And what is Loserpool, I hear you ask? It's a new game that sees betting turned on its head, with the focus being on the loser. If this has grabbed your interest, then be sure to visit loserpool.com and create an account, especially as there's a new prize pool which guarantees a winner £1,000, but now it's free to enter in this one, so it's free to play. There's nothing stopping you. So the odds of winning are great, but they're even better if you sign up. Right then, it's time to go live. And we'll start with the fact that the top race hasn't necessarily been blown wide open as such, but it's certainly seen a couple more twists and turns over the past couple of days. So, first up, it was Man City's defeat to Newcastle, and that was one that had Liverpool fans ready to pass on their well wishes to their former boss, Rafa Benitez, after he masterminded a huge upset. So, Matthew, just why exactly did it not click for City, especially after, they went up 1-0 after, 25 seconds or so? So, where did it go wrong? Why did they not have that usual swagger and rhythm that we usually see with a Pep Guardiola side?
I honestly don't know. I think this could just go down as one of those freak results that we so often see. Like, even Manchester City, when they were... at any point in Manchester City, now they've got their riches, there's still those odd results that make you think, hang on, how the hell's happened? You just can't explain it. Like when they went, I think it was in Pep's first year, when they went and lost 4-1 or 4-0 away at Leicester. It's just, you can't expect Manchester City to turn up and win 5-0 every single week. You just put this one down just one of those days. Maybe if you want to add a little bit into it, on the Newcastle side, because they won the game. It's not all about Manchester City losing. Absolutely, Newcastle did win the game. Maybe there's just a little bit of atmosphere around Tyneside that just got... with all the protests that have been going on, and this was the last game before the transfer deadline window. And maybe it was just a whole combination of things on Tyneside that, it was more what Newcastle did rather than what Manchester City did. Because Rafa Benitez has frustrated big sides before. Like, he famously, there was that whole, I think it was last year, well, it must have been last year, when they went to the Etihad and parked the bus and got away with a 1-0, and only got away with a 1-0 defeat, and we were talking about it for 2 weeks on end. So maybe it's just all credit to Rafa Benitez for putting together a brilliant game plan that kept Manchester City at bay to such an extent that they've only got the one goal, and then it's only on Newcastle to get the goals themselves, which they obviously went and did.
Yeah, I mean, to be honest, you just sort of taken my next point in terms of Rafa Benitez, because he got absolute pelters, didn't he, last season when they met, and he sort of played that super defensive tactic, and it was, I guess, almost like a Pyrrhic victory of, well, we only conceded one. But you're absolutely right, it was a debate that went on forever. It was a case of, well, should he be playing better, more expansive football? Or is he entitled to shut up shop as much as he did? So, do you think he learnt his lesson and thought, do you know what? Obviously, we're not going to go toe-to-toe as such, but let's be a little bit forward-thinking. And perhaps they also grew in belief the longer they kept it at just one.
Yeah, exactly that. For as long as you can keep Manchester City at one, any team at one, you've always got a chance. Then there's always that slight bit of luck with Matt Ritchie's penalty, and just the sheer just a complete brain lapse by Oh, crack. I think it may have been Laporte that gave the penalty away. I'm not 100% sure.
Fernandinho, wasn't it?
Fernandinho. So, don't know why I thought Laporte. I wasn't watching the game 100%. But anyway, no, just one of those things that, you know, next time he'll be a lot more switched on, and, you know, he'll have better peripheral vision and won't give that sort of penalty away. So it's a combination of things that sort of led to the result. It's not just one thing. You can't really pin it down to one thing.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. I think, like you say, it also does a disservice to Newcastle, because it's not a team losing. A team still has to win. And I think, you know, Newcastle was obviously their best performance of the season so far, you could say. So in terms of City losing that game, they would no doubt been expecting the worst, because they've lost and you think, oh no, Liverpool playing the next day. It's a gap that could go to seven. So that would have taken place had they beaten Leicester. Thankfully, though, for City, it's only five. So they would have, I guess, if they did watch that game, they would have thought, oh, here we go again. Because Sadio Mane scored after 2 minutes. And did you feel sort of it's a case of how much Liverpool wanted to score, or did Leicester always have a chance of getting into the game? It was, again, it's just been a weird week, really, isn't it? So how did Leicester manage to sort of match Liverpool last night?
I honestly don't know. Similar to Man City, it's just one of those things, like how did we get to this stage? It shouldn't be like this. You know, when Liverpool go up within 3 minutes, I think it was, then you expect the floodgates to open. But maybe, you know, Claude Puel's been under a lot of criticism for the way he plays his football. It's not entertaining. It's, you know, grinding out results, so on and so forth. So we shouldn't really be 100% surprised by the result. To an extent, if this was, you know, the Premier League's basically divided up into three tiers. There's the top six, there's the rest, and then there's those fighting for relegation. So, and Leicester City are sort of in that the rest pile. So it's not as if Liverpool, drew against Huddersfield. Leicester are a somewhat decent side and do still have very decent players. And, you know, their goal came through Harry Maguire, who I've said for a while is arguably the best centre-half in the country alongside Virgil van Dijk. So it's not as if that Liverpool were playing, you know, were playing a bunch of nobodies. Leicester are still a very, very good side. And on their day, and plus, if you want to put an intangible to it, you could also to an extent say the weather as well is always a great equaliser. You know, the pitch was a bit wet, it sort of slowed the place down a bit. Obviously, Liverpool can't counter-attack or attack in any way, shape or form in the same speed that they normally do. So it's a combination of those two things, the weather and Leicester exactly not exactly being pushovers to some extent.
I guess you could also say that it's Leicester once again saving their best against the very best, because they've beaten Chelsea, they've beaten Man City. So, like you say, it doesn't, because of those big results, it's not the biggest surprise. But, I mean, at the same time, Leicester could have won the game, because if you look at the chances they had Maddison's header in the first half, which sort of looped awkwardly around the post. And then you had Demarai Gray's decision to shoot instead of playing Maddison in the second half. So, will they come away disappointed by the fact they just got a point, or is that a point well earned against the league leaders?
Seeing as they went, you know, they were went 1-0 down incredibly early, I think they'd see it as a point well earned. It's not as if they, you know, they were 2-0 up and then squandered, we're going to touch on it later, you know, like Burnley away at Man United. It's not as if they were in a good position and then threw it away. They were constantly chasing the game. And as you said, had a couple of chances, but, you know, they'd have taken a point at the start of the game. So I don't think I'd be too disappointed about coming away with only a point.
Yeah, I think that's a fair point. But in terms of Liverpool, do you think they should have had a penalty in the second half? I mean, I think it was Mane who got clattered. I can't for the life of me remember who. But it's one of those ones where you think, do you know what? I've seen a lot given for a lot less.
Yeah, absolutely. I personally think it was a penalty in this ever-changing world of no one knows quite what a penalty is these days. But yeah, in my position of watching the replay, I would have given the penalty. But in the position of the referee, no idea what he saw or didn't see, as the case may be. I think I said on the podcast a couple of weeks ago, I'm sort of done debating about the quality of referees, because it's got to a stage where there's nothing until VAR comes in, you just got to grin and bear it and just accept that these decisions are going to be wrong. You know, just wait a couple more months. That's all you got to wait, and then finally we'll be able to get to the bottom of all these decisions when VAR comes in.
Yep, we're nearly there. In terms of Liverpool, though, do you think they'll look at last night's result as an opportunity missed to really turn the screw on City, you know, take up to 7, or will they still be happy at the fact they've at least managed to get it up to 5? You know, is that, you know, are they being sort of greedy by thinking, oh, you know, if we get to 7, or is it still just putting the pressure on City because it's still a little bit more of a gap at the top of the table?
They'll be disappointed to an extent because it's still one and a half game cushion, as it were. It's not, they can only afford to lose 2 games, whereas if they'd have gone 7 points, then they'd have had to have lost a third game ahead of Manchester City. So obviously they'll see it as disappointing, but at the same time, it is still 5 points. They still do have that one game in hand. I can't remember who tweeted it. Basically, there are 14 games left. Liverpool need to win 12 of them. Basically, if they're to match Manchester City, and that's assuming Manchester City win all 14 games they have left. And you know that Manchester City are going to stumble somewhere down the line. So Liverpool can afford to stumble somewhere down the line. I'm trying to think who their tough games are. They've got to go to Wade to Stamford Bridge, or off the top of my head, I don't know. But yeah, back to the initial question. Yeah, they'll be disappointed that they didn't get it to 7. But at the same time, 5, it's not as if they've thrown the lead away, as it were. It's still very much in their hands.
Oh yeah, absolutely. And I think, like I say, if you keep adding a point every third week, then you soon could be up at 7-8 anyway. So, like I say, City have obviously shown they're not this superpower that they were last season. They are not going to be sort of necessarily winning 14 in a row. That'd be some heroic sort of streak to really make the league title interesting. So it is still very much in Liverpool's hands, and even more so with that additional point. But if we look at the race for the top 4 now, and the biggest headline must be Chelsea's capitulation on the South Coast last night. Bournemouth picked up a win at the Vitality Stadium. Perhaps not the biggest surprise, but the magnitude certainly would have been a 4-0 win for Bournemouth. So again, Sarri says that his players are struggling to get motivated, but is it perhaps he who is now the problem?
I don't want to put too much on Mauricio Sarri because it's still January in his first year, so I don't think he can quite get to the stage of lost the dressing room in what 6 months that he's been in charge. I doubt it's got to that stage yet. You know, in the same level as it was with Mourinho or at either of his Chelsea or Man United with Jose Mourinho. I don't want to be making the same points again, but you could just put this down to just one of those days. Again, Bournemouth have shown that they're not exactly pushovers. They've got some incredibly young, good players. You know, David Brooks, speaking as a Welshman, absolutely love the fact that he's tearing teams apart. It's great to see, and it shows why, again, you know, put some things on board, but it's not all about Chelsea. It so showed again that Eddie Howe is probably, to some extent, being held back by Bournemouth. And that's a bit harsh on Bournemouth, but, you know, Eddie Howe is, you know, can manage sort of at above the level he's at, sort of thing. He's obviously got a future in the game, as it were. That's the roundabout way of saying. But yeah, back to Chelsea. I just can't say exactly what it is. If it is whole about Mauricio Sarri, then the fact that they won against Spurs in the FA Cup and won against Nottingham Forest in the league, no, Sheffield Wednesday, sorry, in the league, in the FA Cup, he's not completely given over. It's just the league form that seems to be the issue, and quite why it's just the league form that's the issue. Again, it's just one of those questions I don't think any of us have the ability or the know-how to answer.
I read today that he actually has a habit, or he does, have training sessions on match day. So, and that's something that's taken a real umbrage by the players. They're not enjoying this. So could fatigue have played a part in that, considering they have played a lot of cup games lately? And that also asks the question, why is he doing this? Because it's not as if he's rotating the squad in any way. You know, you've got the likes of Ruben Loftus-Cheek, Hudson-Odoi, Andreas Christensen, who are sort of chomping at the bit to play and not really getting the opportunity. So surely it's either make use of the squad you've got or stop flogging your players on match day before you've even played a game.
Yeah, that's a new insight. Thanks very much for telling me that. I learned something new every day. Yeah, absolutely. I think fatigue, if that's what he's doing, then fatigue absolutely can play a part in it. But if this is something that he's done throughout his career, you know, he's had a very successful career up to this point. So maybe there's something in the players. You know, maybe it's to some extent a bit of an aging squad. You've got David Luiz is certainly not young. Aspilicueta is still getting on a bit. N'Golo Kante's probably burnt out a bit, having played and the way he plays, running about all over the pitch, plus the summer he had with France. Yeah, I suppose fatigue could play a bit in it, and then that sort of gets counteract by when he plays the rotation side in the cup against Sheffield Wednesday. They come away with a good result. So yeah, maybe fatigue is a thing, and it's probably something maybe he can address going forward. Maybe that's why he's got Gonzalo Higuain in, you know, somewhere a new face. He's going to have to some extent fresher legs, and maybe can adapt to the system a little bit better than the likes of Giroud, or maybe that's why Morata wasn't firing. Maybe he doesn't have the level of fitness to keep up with the style of play. Maybe Gonzalo Higuain will.
I mean, reports yesterday said that Sarri locked the players in the dressing room for 15 minutes and the coaches were told to just wait outside, like they're not welcome. So whether it was Sarri just firing out, you know, lamenting for 50 minutes, or whether it was a discourse between the players as well, giving backwards and forwards, I guess we won't really know. But is it a case that Chelsea players are perhaps dropping tools again? Being, you know, when they're actually told to do something, they seem to sort of not really like being taken to task. So is it a toxic environment within the club? Is that rearing its head once more?
Again, I don't want to say that it's turned toxic in January. I can't believe that it's been that bad a turnaround. And you know, there's still some stuff for Chelsea to cheer. They're in the final of the League Cup, so there's a chance to win silverware. So I'm sure they'll get motivated for that. Maybe it's just the fact that it's December now January. There's nothing really going on. It's not like they're in Europe, or you know, they've got something to take their minds off it. Maybe it's just a lack of imagination. And when it comes to the end of the season, when they're progressing through the Europa League and they're getting through the FA Cup, and they'll be on a fight for fourth place, and they'll have something to aim for. Maybe that's all it is. Maybe they just don't have a target in mind. Back towards the end of in the last half of the season, it would have been getting through the Europa League group stage. It would have been getting through the League Cup stages. Whereas now they've actually got a target and something to aim for. Maybe that's all it was. Maybe it was just a lack of motivation. Maybe Mauricio Sarri was right. The fact that they're only playing league games now, it's just somewhat dull for them.
Yeah, it's a fair point. You could also counter that, or add to that, the fact that now they're fifth. It's like, right, we've got to pull our finger out and get back into the top four. So that might be the spark, mightn't it? So, you know, I think that's a very fair point you make, Matthew. But again, let's not just focus on the fact that a bigger team has lost. Let's focus on the fact that, you know, there's been a good result, a good win. And that was obviously Bournemouth. You just touched on David Brooks. And that was going to be my sort of question. He was one of many stars last night. He will arguably get the most plaudits, sorry. So the Cherries, they have a real player on their hands there. And you get the feeling they're going to struggle to keep him at the Vitality long term if this rapid career trajectory continues?
Yeah, but then again, it's going to be a case of who's going to want to come in and buy him. You know, do we see, you know, if this long-awaited move for Eden Hazard eventually goes to Real Madrid, do we see David Brooks filling in Eden Hazard's spot? I mean, he's a good player, but no. Do we see him playing off Romelu Lukaku at Manchester United? Maybe, if, you know, Ole Gunnar Solskjaer, if that fits the way he plays. He's not getting into Spurs' side at the moment because it's still Kane, Ali, Eriksen, Son, when everyone's back from injury, of course. He's not getting into there. Arsenal, maybe, but again, he'd have to take Aubameyang's place. Probably not. Liverpool, maybe, but again, he'd have to displace one of the front three. So I don't think there's really much of a chance for him. And if Bournemouth just keep doing what they're doing and staying in the Premier League, not being in any big relegation battle, then what then why would he leave? What exactly sort of career progression is there if he sees, right, I'm going to, you know, be on the bench for the most part at a big six side or play regularly in a mid-table Premier League club, then why would I leave? What's that? Unless, of course, he goes abroad with these, you know, as we've seen this influx of young British players going abroad, the likes of Jadon Sancho, Raheem Matondo. I think Reece Oxford was being linked to somewhere today.
He's gone.
I knew he was linked. I didn't know if he went. Maybe there's a move abroad. Maybe there's a move abroad for him in the, you know, maybe somewhere in Germany can maybe utilize his talents a lot better. One of the clubs over there. Maybe in Spain. I think he'd fit in quite well. Maybe go and join Juventus. Maybe take Ronaldo's spot. I don't know. But anyway, yeah, it all depends on sort of the time frame and who's in charge and what the sort of domino effect is at each particular club as to whether or not he moves.
Yeah, do you know what? That is a fair point, actually. And I think you can make the same sort of case for Callum Wilson, that kind of, you can either be playing week in, week out at a Premier League club when you're fit, or you might be getting splinters on the bench at a Big Six club, and it's all about what do you really want, I guess. But you actually just reminded me of a question. Rabbi Matondo, he's obviously Welsh. I don't know a great deal about him, but he's joined this sort of German exodus. What can you tell us, the listeners, about him? Because he's quite a precocious talent, one who's sort of tipped for big heights in the next sort of few years. So can he reach those heights? Has he got the potential to go all the way?
He absolutely has the potential. He's a nice little player. Hasn't had the first team game time that maybe some would have had at other clubs. But the fact is, he's going to Germany, and the German clubs have showed that they're going to give him game time. He's not going to be a constant bench warm or go to the under 23s. The Schalke are going to play him, and they obviously have faith in his talent. And the thing is, if he doesn't work out, at least we'll know that he doesn't work out at a certain level. Maybe it was a move too early, but you know, at least he's taken the chance. At least he's taken the risk. He's not going to be sitting in the Manchester City under 18s and under 23s for the next 3 years waiting for his chance. He's going to go there and he's going to get a chance to show his talent. If it turns out that, you know, as I said, the move was too early for him, then maybe, you know, he'll go to the Schalke under 23 squads and, you know, maybe develop there. But at least he's been given the chance to show whether or not he can make it, rather than being, you know, backlogged and being the sixth or seventh choice player at his position as he would be at Manchester City.
Yeah, I think all credit to him. I think anyone who's prepared to sort of make this move to German football, I think it's the smartest decision they'll make, to be honest, because they could always come back to the Premier League. They could be much better for it. Like you say, you know, it's all, like we just mentioned, career trajectory with David Brooks. Obviously, he's getting the minutes that his talents deserve. And I think the fact they're going to Germany and doing that, then I think more power to them. And I just, it's good that young English players are taking a chance, because I think in the past, generations, or not, you know, not generations, but, you know, say 5-10 years ago, young talent has been accused of just collecting the money in England and thinking, okay, that's me done. I don't really need to sort of hit the potential that I can get to. So I think anything that sort of develops those kind of players can only be a benefit to British football as a whole. So
yeah, exactly. And even if he doesn't succeed over there, at least he's given it a go, and B, he'll have learnt another style of play. It's something that, you know, all the pundits when England would go out to major tournaments is, you know, they've only ever played the British style of play. They're not used to playing at the speed or the technical ability of the Spanish league, or with the efficient passing ability of the German players in the German league, sort of thing. So at least he's going to learn a new style of play. And even if he doesn't make a success out of it over there, he can maybe bring some skills back that he learned into the Premier League and then utilise and develop it there.
Yeah, absolutely. I couldn't agree more. So let's move back to sort of the Premier League view. I don't want to work just down the table. Let's mix it up a bit. So that gives you the perfect chance to talk about Fulham. So Matthew, Tuesday night, not the ideal start you would have wanted, as Glenn Murray put Brighton 2-0 up with two first half goals. You must have thought, oh no, here we go again. So just what was the spark exactly? Because four goals is quite the comeback. That said, you had an incredible amount of efforts, I believe. So it wasn't a case of just, you know, taking what chances, you know, in isolation that you had. You absolutely battered Brighton from what I saw. So, yeah, where did that spark come from?
There's been a lot of theories going round as to what it is, but the main one seems to be that during half-time, the players basically turned to Claudio Ranieri and said, your method is not working. Because this was a team that was built and the players were bought to play the Slavica Jokanovic style of way, which was possession-based, quick counter-attacks, whip the ball into Mitrovic to head the goals there. And basically Claudio Ranieri's style of give them the ball, absorb the pressure, and counter-attack, low possession, basically wasn't working. So the theory is that the players just basically had a, I don't want to say a mutiny, but turned around and said, hang on, this clearly isn't working. We're going back to how we played under Jokanovic, maybe with a few tweaks in with your system brought in, like Callum Chambers playing defensive midfield instead of centre-back, whatever. And that's basically the thought behind it, because it's something that's worked in the past. When we were struggling in the 2010-11 season under Mark Hughes, a similar thing happened where the players just went, your way isn't working. We're going back to the way we played under Roy Hodgson. And then we finished from 19th on Boxing Day. We finished 8th in the Premier League. So that's the theory going behind what sort of happened last night, is that's the spark. That's the moment where he said, no, we're going to take over from here on out. And everything just clicked perfectly. As you know, as you said, it's not just the four goals we scored. It's the fact that we absolutely battered them in the second half. We could have had more. Jean-Michel Seri hit the post. Matt Ryan, their goalkeeper, made a couple of decent saves. Sergio Rico, our goalkeeper, probably had the turning point, because after we'd got to 2-2, he made a brilliant save to deny Glenn Murray his hat-trick. And then a couple of minutes later, we went down and took the lead 3-2. So it's one of those things. Turn the momentum as quickly as that. I honestly could go on for 2 hours about just how bonkers this Fulham game was, and quite how it happened. I'm not 100% sure, but it does, as you said, it gives us a bit of a spark. And when you think about who we've got coming up next, it's Crystal Palace minus Wilfried Zaha after he got sent off. I'm sure we're going to touch on that later.
So
this kind of gives us a right. We got one win. Crystal Palace without Zaha, we know that's not the greatest. We might just be able to get something going here. But, you know, but that's the theory, and that's the thinking behind it. Obviously, football's not playing. People, we're gonna have to see. But it just does give us that idea of, if we've been playing like this the whole season, and like basically the second half against Brighton and the first half against Spurs, if we'd have played like that the whole season, we wouldn't be in this mess. It's just the inconsistency of it all is what's got us in this situation.
Yeah, I mean, I was going to say, actually, well, my next question was going to be that it's easy to say that that win could be a pivotal moment, but you have to now make sure that decent performance, or, you know, those 45 minutes is not just something in isolation. You've really got to build on that now, because you've sort of found a spark. It's now you've got to ignite it and see how you can sort of close that gap, because I think it's 6 points now, isn't it? So, you know, it's not just, okay, we've beaten Brighton, back to the drawing board. It's like, right, we've beaten Brighton, we've got to use that momentum.
Yeah, absolutely. Hopefully that's something Claudio Ranieri's taken on board. And if I'm being brutally honest, I wouldn't change anything in the squad, because what you don't want now is for that side that finished the game and ended so well. It ended up in a sort of 4-3-3 formation, because we start off with five at the back. You now don't want, hang on, we've got something here. If we play this way, the way we did 45 minutes, we play that the rest of the season, we could do something. What you don't want then is for Claudio Ranieri to go and buy a defensive midfielder, say, to replace Callum Chambers and move him to centre-back. Say, we have this idea. This is probably our best shot. We don't want to change anything right now, which is why I'm hoping we don't do anything overly drastic in this, as we record, 2.5 hours left of the transfer window.
Talking about Fulham and the transfer window, AK47 has departed to Turkey on loan. Bloody hell, he was a bit of a live one, wasn't he? What on earth was going on last week when he got arrested at the training ground? Like, he's just a bit of a character, one might say.
Yeah, bit of a character. That's the best way to say it. You know, we've known that he's a bit of a fiery character, and not just a fiery character, but a character nonetheless. The fact that he specifically wanted the number 47 when he came here so that he could have AK-47. It's like Mario Balotelli. We should have known from that moment that things went wrong. But the thing is, he doesn't come across like that. He comes across as a bit of a tough guy on the pitch. But all the stuff that's happened with the fallout over the penalty, which I think has been blown way out of proportion in my mind. And this whole training ground, if you believe it, the players have come out and rubbished the story. If it happened, it happened. If it didn't, I'm not overly going to... It's just taken us a bit all by surprise. Whether or not he's a bad egg in the dressing room, the only way we'll find out now is he goes to whatever club it is over in Turkey. I'm not even going to try and pronounce it. Yeah, I'm not going to try. If things turn out there, then we'll know it was him. There was a problem. If things all work out hunky-dory, then maybe there was a couple of issues in the club that maybe got in his way more than himself.
Yeah, I think that's a very interesting way to look at it, actually, that if he keeps getting into scuffles wherever he goes, then you know he's a bad egg. But if it's just he takes the turkey, you know, like a duck to water and starts banging the goal, you think, oh, hang on, there might have been something behind the scenes. So you never quite know until it develops. So we've spoken about your team. Let's talk about my team, Spurs, quickly. From a neutral's point of view, I guess that result against Watford would have been very important because not only in the race for the top four, but also the fact it's halted any talk of the wheels falling off and all that. Because obviously going out of the cup, or two cups in the space of a week, what do you make of Poch's comments that Tottenham have been victims of their own success?
I think there's some level... Hang on. Success? I thought the whole point was that Mauricio Pochettino isn't a success because he hasn't won a trophy. So
well,
that's a
he's saying that they're victims. I guess it's relative success because you're absolutely right. Yeah. We haven't won anything, so you can't really be deemed successful. I guess that's the measure if you're using Champions League football as the yardstick of success, which again is another debate. Do Tottenham, are they right to just be putting all their eggs in a top four basket and opposed to going for the cups? Because it was quite obvious on Sunday that changes were made for Watford in mind. So although we won, I guess the ends justify the means, but it's fired up that debate of what's more important, winning trophies or just being in the Champions League every year. So obviously for Tottenham it's a very raw point, but what do you take from it from a neutral view?
I think there's some level of credibility to that. Is now that, you know, everyone's expecting Spurs to keep moving on and on and on, so there is some level of pressure on them to succeed. And you know, when you have these injury hits, they're obviously going to take you back somewhat. And I believe I was right in saying that all you need to do is don't worry about Harry Kane, just wait for Heung-min Son to come back. He'll come back and save you. And I believe I was right on that.
You'd be fine with
Fernando Llorente. And lo and behold, it looks exactly what happened. My only one concern about this is with Heung-min Son, is there not a level of, you know, we talked about earlier, is there not a question of burnout, maybe?
Oh, absolutely.
The fact that
he was
rushed back from the Asia Games and now is sort of needed to cover for Harry Kane and Fernando Llorente. And again, we're going to assume that in the next 2.5 hours, Daniel Levy's not going to sign a centre-forward / striker to take some of the weight off. So it is going to be very much Llorente and Son heavy. But on Honeyman's side, is there not a worry of the fact that he's going to be playing so many games and this is just going to affect him? You talked about fatigue towards the end of the season.
I think you're absolutely right in the sense that last night he went down with cramp, but as soon as the final whistle, he just collapsed. He wasn't even meant to be on the pitch when he scored. Poch just said to his assistant staff, like, we've got to take a gamble. We're 1-0 down. We've got nothing left. You know, there's no plan B. So he'd done a full shift and you have to be really, really careful now because if he breaks, like, we are doomed. So I think it's not, you know, kid gloves and such, but we've got to be really, really careful in what we do with Son. So, from an outsider's point of view, do you think they can be fine against Newcastle and Leicester as well? Because we've got them both at home, so it's three home games in a row. Do you reckon Tottenham can get a full 9 points sweep from those three?
Yes, I believe they can. It honestly depends which Newcastle and Leicester turn up.
That's right.
As recent results have shown. But overall, yes, absolutely, Spurs should be able to get 9 points, and I think Spurs are probably going to coast towards the end of the season, out of the title race as much as it is, and there's just such a big cushion between them and the team in fifth that as long as nothing catastrophic happens, then they're going to get into the top four. So it's literally just literally the only thing Spurs have to look forward to this season, because they're not winning the Champions League either, is just waiting to see if that move to the stadium does indeed come before the end of the season or not.
Yep, again, I don't think that's going to happen, but that's a story for another episode. So let's go to Old Trafford now, because Spurs would have been important in the race for the top four, although at the same time, Ole Gunnar Solskjaer has shown that he's mortal, because his winning streak's finally come to an end. I guess, rather surprise opposition, because if you're a betting man, you'd have been absolutely bugging him midweek, because not only have had the coupon busters that we've just mentioned, there's also Burnley getting a draw at Man United. So at one point, it looked like Burnley were going to get all 3 points. However, it was almost a comeback of the Sir Alex Ferguson era. So what did you think of Jesse Lingard's penalty decision? Was it a bit soft, or with Hendrick putting his arm on him, has he got every right to go down in the way he did?
No, as soon as I saw that, I said, nah, that's a penalty. It was one of, in my mind, it was one of the more clearer penalty decisions of the week. If he'd have just sort of tapped him on the shoulder and Lingard had gone down, then you could have understood there'd been a bit of a drip. But you can see that Hendrick more or less does drag him down. So I've no complaints about that penalty being given.
And talking of Burnley, I mean, it looks like they've turned the corner. I think, well, to be fair, they have really, because 11 points from the last 15 on offer, unbeaten in the last five, 3 wins and 2 draws. Would you say that Sean Dyche has looked at what's happened in the first sort of third of the season or first half of the season and thought, you know what, right, we just need to go back to basics. Starting with at the back, Tom Heaton in goal. I know he's obviously been injured, but as soon as he's fit, get him in. And now all of a sudden, the Clarets are playing to their strengths once more, and it's no real surprise that they are starting to get points back on the board.
Yeah, exactly. You know, they're playing to their strengths. You know, Burnley under Sean Dyche are always going to be similar to Sam Allardyce's Bolton team back 15 years ago. You know, they're not going to win much. They're not going to be battling really hard for relegation. They may get a couple of weeks being scared towards the bottom, but you know that this side is a very, very good, capable Premier League side. So as long as all guns are firing, then they'll always be safe. As long as they've got a fit and healthy team.
Yep. What do you make of Peter Crouch coming back to the Premier League for Burnley? Bit of a weird one, that.
Yeah, if I'm being brutally honest, I honestly thought he'd retired, because I all this stuff, because he does his own podcast.
That's right,
I honestly just thought once he'd gone down, I honestly thought he retired. I didn't know he was still playing until I think he scored for Stoke at Shrewsbury in the FA Cup. Other than that, I forgot he was still there. Good on him, though. At the age of whatever it is, about 36, 37, I'd imagine.
38 yesterday.
38, even more. The fact that a Premier League club wants to come and sign him just shows that he's obviously still got something in the tank. So full credit to him. And I think he's either going to, if he scores, he either ties or breaks the record for most Premier League goals scored with different clubs, which is Craig Bellamy with 7. So that's going to be one of those fascinating things to see towards the end of the year.
Wow.
Is just that one graphic on Match of the Day, you know, Peter Crouch ties record with Craig Bellamy or breaks Craig Bellamy's record of most of goals scored with different Premier League clubs. It's one of those little tidbits to watch out for for the rest of the season.
That's a fantastic bit of trivia. I'm trying to think off the top of my head. So Tottenham, Liverpool, Portsmouth, Villa, Stoke. What would the other two be?
Southampton.
Southampton, yep. And there's one more. Is it QPR?
QPR won Premier League at this stage.
Right. We try not to do this live. Obviously, it could be all night. But that is a fantastic bit of trivia. I'll let me do my research and I'll get back to you on that one. But yeah, if Burnley would be the eighth. So there's one more missing. I don't know if it's Norwich. Maybe. I don't know. We'll have to have a look. But in terms of that area of the table, Burnley, we didn't quite have a 6-pointer at St Mary's last night, but it was still an important game between Southampton and Palace. Honours even, but the talking point would have been red cards. And, you know, there was some that might have been, but there was one that definitely was, not because what, you know, a robust tackle, but because of getting tackled, I guess, Will Sahar sort of lost it, didn't he? Bit of petulance, and then even more so again in front of the referee. So technically, he only has himself to blame, but does he need more protection?
No, protection, that's a whole different debate. I honestly thought that first yellow card was a bit harsh. It wasn't like a slap or a punch or a shove or anything. He just basically batted an arm away. I think that was a bit harsh for the yellow card, which then leads to him being booked for the second book for sarcastically clapping. Get out the third time. So if it wasn't for a bit of a soft yellow card, then he doesn't get a second yellow card, so on so forth. But in terms of protection, that comes down to your idea of if whether or not football's gone soft and the kind of football you want to see played. Like, I've always been one for a bit of physicality in football. So if you were to ask me, I think no, he should, you know, man up and deal with it. It's not as if he's actually getting, from a standing start, getting his leg actually swiped from underneath him. It's just a little bit of a physical barge, whereas someone else you might ask who prefers a nice, gentle passing football might say, no, he's being kicked to death. So personally, from my side, no, I think what's going on is just about fine. But it depends who you ask whether or not he deserves quote-unquote protection.
Yeah, I don't think... Can you really offer protection to players in this day and age? I mean, like I say, unless you're going to start booking everyone, you're going to get to a point where there's no one left on the pitch because everyone's accumulated too many yellow cards, isn't it? So you don't really want the game going that way. But, you know, Gary Lineker said on Match of the Day last night that Zaha almost has to take it as a mark of respect because defenders fear him. Now, is there an element of truth in that?
Yeah, I think there's some element of truth in that. You can just see the way he plays and how important he is to his team. That absolutely teams fear him. You know, if you can close him down, then you basically close the rest of the team down. So yeah, absolutely, I can see why he'd say that.
Did you see Ralph's, I can't be bothered to say his surname, his comments a little bit barbed towards Mark Hughes about how former managers haven't been able to spot talent? I think the fact that Ralph has been more prepared to sort of play younger players, and it's like, well, if Hughes had done that, Southampton might not have been in the mess that they currently did find themselves in when he took the job.
To some extent, I think every regime doesn't like the regime that came before it, especially if you're in a bad place as you are with Southampton. The situation we're in now, it's not because of me, it's because of the regime before. So every new manager's gonna come in and say that. So I'm not exactly surprised by his comments. No.
Yeah, I think that's fair enough, actually. It's always the case of, well, it's not my fault. Like, I'm trying to get us out of this mess. But not in a mess, are Wolves. You almost forget they're a promoted team because they're flying. They're seventh, the best of the rest, in inverted commas. 7 goals in the last 2 league outings. So they certainly hit a purple patch in terms of goal-scoring form. But can they go the distance and actually earn what could well now be a Europa League place? Let's assume that a small club doesn't win the FA Cup. It's sort of everything's going to type. So can Wolves be the best of the rest?
Yeah, absolutely. They can. I don't see any reason why they couldn't. If you look at the teams around them, Everton seem to be on a bit of a bad patch under Marco Silva. For some reason he's getting pressure. And then you look at the rest of the teams around them. It's Watford, Bournemouth, City, West Ham. No teams that are gonna really going to impress you on a major basis. So yeah, Wolves, the way they're going, absolutely, why not? And it'd be a fantastic achievement for them, and it would be deserved for them, because it then goes to show other teams that, you know, these things can happen. And if you stick to, this is a message to Mrs. Fulham, if you stick to what got you promoted, then absolutely, you can go and do very well in the championship. You don't have to be fighting for your life in your first season, if you do things the right way, then you can absolutely go up and fly through the rest of the table.
What do you make of Nuno Espirito Santo as a manager? I mean, if Tottenham do lose Poch in the summer, I would love it if they went for him. I would make him my personal number one replacement. So, do you think he's got sort of the managerial credentials to manage a big club eventually, or will that big club be Wolves?
That's an interesting shout. That's the first time I've actually heard his name being brought up for one of the quote-unquote bigger teams, because it's, you know, for the past 2 or 3 years, it's been Eddie Howe's been the man in waiting. So whenever one of the big team loses their manager, it's meant to be Eddie Howe taking his job. Absolutely. But now you say it, Santo, yeah, why not? I think if he goes and does this sort of thing next year, because we don't want to be brought in with... Because Tony Pulis with Stoke and Phil Brown with Hull did this sort
very
of thing.
True, very,
you know, that
true.
First season, that first season, the Premier League did really well. But it's, I'm not comparing the styles of play by any means. But it's not okay. You could do this once, but now once we've had a season of watching you play in the Premier League, you've had your year to adapt. You know, to some extent, you're taking us by surprise because we haven't seen this style of play before. It's always about the second season that we start to judge. So if he does a similar thing next year and he ends, you know, 7th, 8th, 9th, 10th, then yeah, absolutely. I don't see any reason why you shouldn't want to link his name to one of the quote-unquote bigger clubs. But at the same stage, if there's a project going on at Molineux, you know, we've seen that they're developing the stadium. If they're going to, you know, invest this money they're going to make in the Premier League into a decent academy, because you think that should be a really good hotbed for young talent in Wolverhampton, if that's going to be their way of bringing things through, then yeah, why not want them? Why not maybe turn Wolves into one of those big clubs? Either way, I think yes, yeah, Santo could be the man to do it.
Yeah, and the team they beat, West Ham, why are they so inconsistent? You know, they had a good win against Arsenal the other week, dumped out the cup, smashed to pieces by Wolves. You would never bet on them, would you? Because you just don't know what you're going to get from one week to another.
No, and I can't tell West Ham from one week to the other. They've sort of gone under the radar a bit. There's not been that... They've been very quiet this season. It's very different to as it was the last couple of years when there was all that fighting with the board and, you know, we're not getting used to the stadium, so on and so forth. Maybe it's just West Ham are just sort of setting back and don't want to, maybe because they're not trying hard. So I don't want to sort of disparage or say anything too libelous about them, but maybe they're just not trying hard, so we're just a bit shocked by these shock results, you know, when they come along. I honestly can't put words to it by West Ham, as I can't with a lot of the clubs this season.
Everton, they beat Huddersfield. Obviously, they were dumped out the cup by Mills. They bounced back. What do you make of Marco Silva as a manager? Because he seems to either be... I don't know if it's like Emperor's New Clothes. Sometimes he's sort of lauded as this new continental talent, and other times he's sort of lauded as a bit of a snake oil salesman. He sort of talks a good game, but flats to deceive. So what do you make of the job he's doing on Merseyside?
I'll be brutally honest. I've never been impressed by Marco Silva with anything he did. When he first came into the Premier League with Hull, I'll cut him some slack because it was Hull. But at the same time, they didn't win a single point away from home, and he still got them relegated. I don't care how he improved their style of play. He still got them relegated. When Roy Hodgson, this is my rant time. When Roy Hodgson took over Fulham in 2008, he kept us up. I don't remember one single article saying, "Oh, Roy Hodgson, he's the next big thing. He's, you know, he can manage at Arsenal," which for some reason was being touted by Marco Silva when he was relegated with Hull. Then he went to Watford, and within 4 months, he wanted to go and join to Everton. He just seems a bit of a disloyal character, and he seems a bit of a mercenary to me. Because after he took the job at Everton, I think he'd been at four different clubs, Olympiacos, Hull, Watford, Everton, in the four clubs in the space of 18 months. He just seems a bit of a mercenary to me. And if I'm being brutally honest, their style of play doesn't jump out at me on the screen. It's, you know, I'm not tuning in specifically to see Everton. I'm not excited by their style of play. So in the grand scheme of things, I'm hugely not a fan of Marco Silva. Quite frankly, I'm glad he's under pressure, because maybe finally everyone's starting to work out that he's not all that great, as I didn't think he was all that great to begin with.
Do you know what? You got that bang on the money, and I couldn't agree with you more. Like I say, it's just like Emperor's New Clothes, and he's lauded as this sort of manager who's getting tipped for big jobs, but he's not a loyal character, is he, from what we've seen? And he sulked at Watford because he couldn't go to Everton, and then they just binned him off. So, yeah, I think he's sort of been shown up, really, because Everton had this big dream of hitting the top six this season, and they're not going to hit the top six like in the next two or three years. I don't think they're cut out for that at all. If anyone's going to do it, it will be Wolves. So I think the value of Silva has very much plummeted. In terms of managers, though, Huddersfield, they've obviously named a new one, Jan Siewert, the third manager to come from Borussia Dortmund 2. You've got Wagner, Falke, Siewert. So obviously this pipeline, we talk about German clubs buying British players. We've now got English clubs getting young German managers. So there's obviously a bit of a talent swap, but no new manager bounced straight away at Huddersfield. But again, it's almost the impossible job for him, really, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly. And I'm sort of somewhat curious as to what Huddersfield's line of thinking was when appointing him, because this is his first senior appointment, managing a senior team. So it is a bit of a big jump, as we found out with Kit Simmons at Fulham. When you jump from managing the kids to managing the grown men's team, it is a bit of a jump. So maybe there's some thinking of, we're just going to surrender the rest of the season, we're down, give him 6 months to sort of familiarise himself with the squad and go for a full charge when we're in the Championship next season, because there's no way that he was brought in purely to get them out of relegation. Otherwise, they would have gone with one of the relegation specialists like a Tony Pulis or a Big Sam. So this is obviously a forward-thinking appointment, and whether or not it works out, you know, we won't find out for another 18 months or 2 years.
Yeah, it's not about this season, is it? It's about how they bounce back, or if they can bounce back, and how he can work in the Championship. And I think they all sort of brace themselves for the impact of relegation. And I think that's just, petering out, really. Like I said a couple of weeks back, when Burnley appointed Brian Laws, what was it, like 9 years ago, you know, they just knew that there was nothing worth getting in a big-name manager trying to do a salvage job. It is, the work's already done. So not good news for Huddersfield fans, but, you know, I think it's not something that's unexpected either. So where are we? Yeah, about 53, 54 minutes in, so just need to wrap things up. We've whistled through the last sort of, 53, 54 minutes. So Arsenal, they moved up to fourth after a win against Cardiff, and it's been obviously a difficult week for Neil Warnock and his men. So as a market respect, we're not really going to sort of touch on that game too much, because I think, you know, it's, like I say, it's not really been a great week for Cardiff. So in terms of off-pitch action, we've obviously hitting the transfer deadline. Like you said, offline, it's not been a great window, but in terms of not just today, but over the course of the last month, has anything caught your fancy in terms of good business?
In terms of good business, no. No,
you're right.
There's not a single signing where I could see, right, that's going to turn their season around, or, oh, they were very good to get him off the books. I suppose the biggest signing of this window has been Gonzalo Higuain to Chelsea. He's one of the names that's been linked with the Premier League for so long that finally we actually get to see it. Right, can he do it? Maybe he'll be, you know, a bit long, because I think he's in his 30s now, so he'll be one of these. He won't be as great, you know, as he has been in his previous year. He wasn't all that good a player after all. So the fact that Gonzalo Higuain to Chelsea is the biggest, it just shows. It's not been the greatest of transfer windows as a whole, if we're being brutally honest. And to be fair, Yeah, there's this talk about getting rid of the January transfer window. Maybe this is clubs' way of protesting and saying, right, we're not going to do any big business because we don't want this thing to happen anyway. So maybe next year we won't even have a January transfer window just because of how bad this one's been.
That's an interesting concept, actually. Do you think that could work, that Premier League clubs are only allowed to buy in that off-season? So you got from, say, June the 1st to August the 1st or something like that, before the Premier League starts again. Could that work, where you're literally locked into that's all you've got and it's a real test of management? There's no January escape route or, you know, emergency signings. Do you think that would work or make it the Premier League better?
Better as a point of view. But yeah, absolutely, I'd go for it, because I've been saying for a while that the way to fix a problem shouldn't be to go out and buy something. If you have an academy, by all means, so this maybe is a Premier League thing, because I know the academy systems aren't the greatest when you go down the leagues, but Premier League academies should be able to cope, and have enough players to fill the void. So if you do get, Harry Kane gets injured, rather than going out and trying to sign a forward, bring up the kid from the academy. I have no idea who it is. I'm sure you'll know who the replacement is, being a Spurs fan. But yeah, just bring up the conveyor belt. That's what we want as fans, is to get the academy kids a go. So rather than going out and spending, I'll get an example. Bournemouth went and signed Chris Meppham from Brentford for about 20 million. As much as I think that's a good bit of business, I think it would have been better if Bournemouth had dipped into the academy and said, right, John Smith or whatever, academy player X, right, you're going to be making the jump up to the first team now. So I personally, that's the way I would want things going forward. So that's why I think there's the argument to get rid of the January transfer window, because it forces managers to go into the academy.
Yeah, I think that's a very solid argument you make. And also, if we touch on our sort of point about academy stars going over to Germany, they'd get the minutes that they would sort of desire. So it would be a win-win. And I think it would be a better test of coaches, because you're not just sort of relying on, dare I say, sort of financial doping and all that. It's a real test of, right, you know, I've got this nucleus of players for eight, nine months, and it's like, what can I actually do with them? And I think that would be a real test of who are good managers, and, you know, it would alleviate or eradicate the checkbook manager that we see in this day and age. So, a very good concept. I like it. Where it happens, though, I don't know. One last thing I need to push you for. Loserpool pick of the week. Have you got a guaranteed loser for me this week?
Yes, I think I hinted at it earlier. Given their form without their main man, and given his red card earlier, Crystal Palace are guaranteed losers against Fulham this week. And I can't believe I'm saying that given our away record this year. But wow. Yeah, Crystal Palace guaranteed losers against Fulham.
I'm going to go for Arsenal to lose away at Manchester City. City, they're going to be something of a wounded beast on Sunday. Obviously, they've lost to Newcastle on Tuesday night. They can't afford to lose two in a row. Not only that, but they play before Liverpool, so they can get the gap down to 2 points temporarily, albeit for, what, 24 hours, with Liverpool playing on Monday night. So, you know, usually it's Liverpool playing first and asking questions of Manchester City. This time, it's their way round. So I don't think City will be in a generous mood. They'll be out to kill off Arsenal, and I think it will be Arsenal who are my guaranteed losers. And that's about it for tonight. Just need to thank Matthew on behalf of myself. It's been an absolute pleasure to have him on, as always. I'm sure we'll do it again soon. And I hope you listen to me again soon. So, with that in mind, my name's Dan Tracy. This is The Real Football Cast, in association with Loserpool. And until next time, goodbye.